Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
Today we are past Easter and we are going to revisit some of the Easter regalia, festivities and controversies. And we are also going back to some of the previous recordings which we have done, specifically on the work of Andy Collins, who has made some major discoveries in Egypt. So starting with Andy, perhaps. Andy has been trying to find for the past two years, an awful lot of interest into a discovery called the Tomb of Birds. And over the last few months, he has published a book on this, he has had press releases, he's been at conferences, he was even speaking to the great man Zahi Hawass himself. Zahi Hawass is supreme deity of ancient Egypt, and over various articles I have been trying to show that really it is a dictatorial regime which he has. And fair enough, all of a sudden, guess what? It has happened again. Zahi has taken absolute control over the Tomb of Birds. Now, just to go into a bit of detail, because it's once again shows you what is so reprehensible, not just about Zahi Hawass, but about this kind of technique all around. First of all, for a year, Andy Collins tried to get the archaeology and the establishment scientists involved into his discovery, which he said was phenomenal. And they said, no, that's not the case. He's making it up. He's not a proper archaeologist. That cannot be. We all know, apparently, to find something, you have to be an archaeologist. So after a year, he managed to get Zahi Hawass interested. Zahi Hawass began to dig. And he now has agreed that the Tomb of Birds is extremely interesting, even though he says he knew about it all along. He then said that the tomb is just a man-made structure and that it is not an actual natural cave system. And this is very important because Andy Collins is convinced that this cave system goes all the way into the very heart of the Giza Plateau, and that the ancient Egyptians just molded some of the structures into the opening to make it look more posh, better, and fit for purpose. But that actually this is probably going to go all the way down into the Giza Plateau and potentially into very interesting territory. Zahi Hawass has denied it's a natural cave system, despite the fact that there are hundreds of photographs, and even as late as a few months ago, at the end of 2009, somebody else has gone in there with video camera, and on the internet he has posted all of his material, showing clearly that this is not just a man-made structure, but also a natural cave. The very next thing which Zahi Hawass has done, which he has done a few weeks ago, is slap a big metal grate in front of it, so nobody is able to go in anymore without his permission, without going via the great dictator himself. So we are back to the old ways of ancient Egyptology, and nothing has changed. Once again, we see that a discovery which has been made by an amateur archaeologist has been completely hijacked, in this case, by the establishment, without even a thank you note for the work Andy Collins and all his mates have done.
If Andy Collins is waiting for a thank you note from Zahi Hawass, I'm afraid he's going to have a really long wait.
Unfortunately, that's so the case, Kathleen. It's once again underlines how dictatorial and how without any due respect Zahi Hawass is behaving. He is hopefully going to retire. He's supposed to be retiring somewhere in the summer, and it'll be interesting to see whether he is actually going to retire or not, because he was supposed to retire on a number of previous occasions, but political allies have kept him in his position because he fulfills a very interesting job. And we will link on the webpage to an article which I had published in Nexus a few months ago, which kind of shows how Mr. Hawass gets around.
Would you like to take bets on whether or not Mr. Hawass retires in the summer? Because I'm willing to place that bet. You will not convince me that as long as there is breath in that man's body that he is going to step down from his position as what you so aptly call supreme deity of Egyptian archaeology. He is the grand master. He is the sole ruler. And I don't think he's going to give that up willingly. So unless he is pushed out, I don't think you're going to see Zahi Hawass step down anytime soon. I do want to say shout out to our beautiful friend Andy Collins and his wife Sue for the tremendous work that they have done. And what I want to say to them is they should be really proud of themselves, because when Zahi is afraid of you enough to shut down your ability to investigate and put up metal, huge iron gates embedded in concrete to keep you out, it means that you're doing something right. So it's kind of like getting being followed by the Vatican. It means you're doing something really, really right. So I want to congratulate Andy and Sue for being so brave in their discovery and going public with it and showing pictures. Because if you remember going back, just to remind our audience a little bit, and we did a full show. We did two shows with Andy Collins, and they are archived on our website. So I heartily recommend you go back and listen to him, because he's so fascinating and he's so smart and he is so brave in his discoveries and his intrepid nature to really get to the truth. The thing about this that's so frustrating for me is all the contradictions that he encountered from the Egyptian government and from traditional archaeology. So from the very beginning, when he said, look, I've made this incredible discovery, they all said, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. We're just going to pretend like it didn't happen because you're not one of us, and we're going to invalidate it because you don't get to do that. You're an amateur, and you don't get to have this experience. You know, and he didn't give up, and he and Sue, they kept going back and saying, look, we have made this incredible discovery. And finally, when it became clear that they could not say no, you didn't anymore, because they were publishing their photographs and they were talking about it publicly, all of a sudden they said, oh, yeah, well, we knew about it. We've known about it all along, and now we're going to take control of it. But as with everything else, whether it's biblical scholarship or archaeology, it's this idea of keeping the truth away from the great unwashed masses that all of us are. And controlling it, that is, to me, just so frustrating and, you know, potentially reprehensible. What are they hiding, and why are they hiding it?
Exactly. And coming back to that bat, I just remembered a quote from, I think it was a documentary about Madonna, and Bat with Madonna or something. And they interview Warren Beatty at one moment in time during that documentary. And Warren Beatty says about Madonna, there is no life for Madonna off camera. And the same applies to Zahi Hawass. Unless his wife buys a very nice and expensive camera and constantly holds it very close up to Zahi Hawass's face, then Zahi Hawass indeed will probably never retire.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. But again, it is for those of us who care so much about all these new discoveries and all, because there is so much happening. There is so much waiting, just bursting forth to come forward right now in the 21st century. I mean, it's part of the spirit revolution, isn't it? There is an element of the spirit revolution that we don't have any control over. It's not about what we do. It's about the circumstances that are being presented to us. And a lot of those circumstances are discoveries. A lot of new information is coming to the forefront. A lot of new documents, a lot of new archaeological discoveries, a lot of new and incredibly exciting information. And it's interesting and also frustrating and sometimes tragic to watch the traditional responses to all of this new information. And for me to see the Egyptian government just sort of going back to its old ways of let's just put a gate and a padlock and a guy with a machine gun in front of it, it's just so sad to me. Now, I will bet that their point of view is going to be that they are trying to protect it and that they are trying to protect people from going in there and getting hurt. And maybe there is, you know, some validity to that. But once again, if they would, you know, really start releasing information about this and really talking about it, then I would feel a lot less like it's a cover-up and an attempt to keep out those who really want to get to the true nature of this underground cave system in Giza, which is spectacular and so interesting.
Exactly. And what has changed since a few months ago is that because of the clear-up which Hawass and co. have been doing there, when... when Andy Collins, Sue, and various other people since went in there, at one point, a few hundred yards in, they got blocked. They couldn't go any further. When I say a few hundred yards, it wasn't even 100 yards, but kind of, you know, at a distance in, they couldn't go any further because it wasn't safe. Now, the Egyptian government has been working there, and as a result of that, it's a possibility that anybody wandering in there could actually go further than previously anybody could. And I think that's one of the prime reasons why that gate is there, because they don't want anybody to walk too far in there.
Well, I think that the proof becomes what happens next with Andy and Sue. Do they contact the Egyptian government and ask them if they can still continue their research with permission? And are they given permission to do that? I think that will tell us whether or not this is about cover-up or about safety.
Absolutely. And once again, we have to believe the great Zahi Hawass on his word, whether or not something is going to be discovered. And we all know how well worth his worth is.
He's launching, by the way, there is a new documentary coming out later on in the year with National Geographic, I believe, about Cleopatra and about all the work they've been doing to unearth some of the archaeological information about Cleopatra. So that will be interesting to see where it goes. She is certainly a major character in history that I am fascinated with, and I will be riveted to it. I won't lie to you. I will watch every second of it. I will devour the accompanying books and the documentaries. But once again, Zahi is in the middle of it. It's not strictly a National Geographic documentary. It is a Zahi Hawass documentary. So there he is on camera all the time. Is that necessarily a bad thing? You know, not if you're a television personality, not if that's what you do. But if you are a government official who is supposed to stand for something somewhat objective, then I think that the lines begin to blur there a little bit. And it becomes a lot more about what is serving Zahi Hawass's public relations agenda versus what is actually really serving the truth here.
And specifically that in the past, for getting his close-up on documentaries, he has made fake revelations and also has guided camera teams in to stand in front of things which actually had nothing to do with what he was talking about. So there's a lot of this spin that really the drive is to get Zahi's close-up on camera as much as possible, rather than anything to do with science. And it's like, you know, like, when American Idol and all of these things came about, the music industry at first kind of like said, what is this all about? This isn't how the music industry works. And within the same, within the field of archaeology, the same reaction is kind of like, well, you know, these discoveries of archaeology shouldn't just be judged whether or not Zahi Hawass can get them on camera or not. So there's a bit of a parallel there.
Well, again, I just want to say to Andy Collins and Sue Collins, you've done tremendous work. You have really, really furthered this field and really opened our eyes to some incredibly important things that are happening in the Giza Plateau. And I know that I personally will be watching every second of it very carefully.
Absolutely. And what happened last week as well was that it was, of course, Holy Week. And you and I have both independently been focusing on two aspects of the Shroud, which is obviously typical for Holy Week and specifically for Easter, because if there is one thing which kind of like I came across and formulated like a catchphrase, if you want to, of what the Shroud is all about, then really it is the best evidence available to believe that the resurrection happened. And it is it's an enigma. It's science cannot explain it. And I have been digging into the Oviedo Shroud, but Americans have been able to watch on the History Channel a very fascinating documentary.
This documentary was stunning, and I talked about it really briefly last week, but I just want to emphasize it's going to be on again. I think it's showing through most of the month of April. If you are in the United States, it is called The Real Face of Jesus. It is a two-hour documentary, and it features this really sort of fascinating work done by a company called Macbeth Studios, run by a man named Ray Downing, where they have taken basically the information of the image on the shroud. And this is a very difficult thing. And it's hard to sort of summarize it. But it's very difficult to get the image information off the shroud because it is so faded and because it is not made with any kind of pigment that anybody recognizes. There is no color on the shroud. There is no paint. There is no pigmentation. There is just this sort of strange gradation that creates this image that no one can identify. There is blood on the shroud, by the way. There is human blood on the shroud, which you will get into in a minute because you're going to talk about how it relates to Oviedo. But what Ray Downing and his team did is they took this image information from the shroud and they translated it into a 3D picture of what this man may have actually looked like. And it is so dramatic and it is so stunning and it is so well done. And what I say to everyone who's listening is, regardless of what your perspective is on the shroud, and we have certainly talked about this on our Shroud of Turin shows in the past, whatever, no matter how skeptical you are, at least watch this documentary and watch it for the sheer science of it. Watch it for the sheer genius of the people who are involved. For me, there was as much joy watching these people who care so much about this subject and were so passionate about getting more information. That's when I watch the people on this Shroud documentary, whether it's Barry Swartz or who was the original photographer with Stirp, who has been involved with it for now 25 years, or Ray Downing and his team, what I see with all of these people is men who did not have an agenda. They did not walk into this with any kind of spiritual agenda. In fact, you know, Barry talks about how he was a skeptic when he walked into it. So there's this amazing sort of objective perspective that these guys walk into it with, and to watch their awe as they see this unfold and to listen to them talk about how many anomalies there are, how impossible it is to explain this, that whatever you think the shroud is, it is definitively unique. There is nothing else like it in the world. There is so much about it that cannot be explained. And one of the things that I really loved about this documentary is I think it really captures that beautifully. This one and a documentary we've talked about before, The Fabric of Time, I think really capture those anomalies of what the shroud contains in terms of data. So I, again, whether you're a skeptic or a believer, watch this show for the sheer joy of observing really brilliant people at work, because I think that there is as much to celebrate in that, in this, in their genius and their dedication to their work, as there is in the ultimate results. And the ultimate results are spectacular. Don't get me wrong. I wept, you know, for quite a long time after the last, after viewing those last few minutes of this documentary. It was extremely powerful for me because I am a believer. But even if you are not, I really think that there is something really to celebrate in this documentary. It is excellent.
And I have been reading a book on the Oviedo Shroud, and the Oviedo Shroud is very interesting, and it's something which, you know, I just want to go into. It's become, next to the Shroud, my favorite Christian relic now, because, well, first of all, they're tied together, and just to give you an idea of what the Jewish custom would have been of burying a man like Jesus once he had died on the cross, they would have wrapped a sheet around his head for various reasons, specifically because the Jews had a very strict discipline to do with blood, but also because rigor mortis was setting in, and obviously this wasn't the most pleasant of things to watch for the people around him. Then he was taken down. He might have been wrapped up in a different shroud, and then he was transported to the tomb where his body was prepared, and a new linen cloth was wrapped around him. And then when you read into the Gospel of John, what Janice Bennett, who's one of the principal scholars to do with the Oviedo Shroud and the lines, is that actually in the Gospel of John in chapter 25-9, you will read that Simon Peter enters the tomb after Mary Magdalene has seen the fact of what has been happening there. And in the Gospel of John, it specifically says that the sudarium was rolled to one side, where it was placed on Good Friday, and then that the shroud was there, and then that the beloved disciple or the other disciple somehow from the way the shroud was lying there, and maybe even the image which was visible already on the shroud, believed what Mary Magdalene had been saying when she came out of that tomb some time before. Now, that is a sequence. So there is there's two, potentially three shrouds. And Janice Bennett has been on the trail of specifically the head protection, which would have been around Jesus when he was taken from the cross and then transported to the tomb. Now, what she's reporting on is scientific research going back to 1987, when a small group of scientists gathered around in Oviedo and began to look into the Oviedo Shroud. They found out so many things that it is simply phenomenal. First of all, they have identified the blood type AB as being identical to that on the shroud. They have also found that the mixture of blood and bodily fluids which are present on the Oviedo Shroud highlight the fact that this person was dead. They have been able to show from the way there are blood stains on this shroud that, for example, there was blood coming from the nose, that there were other wounds, that his head was held by somebody during transport, that he had long hair in a pigtail, that he had a beard and a moustache, that he definitely was hanging up vertically for a period of time, that the cloth was around that person in this position for about an hour, before it was around the same person for once again an hour in a flat position. All of these things they have been able to scientifically establish. They have also been able to establish, for example, the pollen. The story of the Oviedo Shroud is that it was obviously in Jerusalem, that it then was taken to Alexandria, that it was then taken to Spain, where it is to this very moment in time. And once again, the pollen on this shroud highlight that this is the case. So an enormous amount of information is being gathered from this Oviedo Shroud. But the killer is this. The Oviedo Shroud is definitely known to have been in existence in 1075 AD. Its existence has been non-controversial since about the 7th century AD. People are pretty willing to accept that it is even older. The Shroud of Turin officially is said to come from the 14th century AD because we all know, don't we, that it's been carbon dated to roughly that period of time and hence it's a medieval fake. Well, what the research of the Oviedo Shroud has shown is not only that the same person is the same blood type, the same pollen, all of these identical things are on both shrouds, but that when you transpose one image, one shroud over the other, they are a perfect match. One body had these two things lying on top of them. And that is a killer conclusion, which to me just completely shatters this rather limited frame in which the Turin Shroud is always discussed. And it really just pushes the envelope so much and also pushes it into the direction of saying this carbon dating thing should really be discarded now. And the possibility that the shroud is genuine has so much dramatically increased that it is really a fantastic bit of research which, as I said, people have been doing on the Oviedo Shroud for about 30 years now.
Well, and you've done terrific research recently on the Oviedo Shroud, and you have taught me so much about it. But I just want to back up for people who are listening who may not have heard of it. Oviedo is a church in Spain where this shroud has been. And it can be very confusing when you're new to this subject because there's a lot of interchangeable terminology. So you'll sometimes hear it referred to as the Sudarium. So the Sudarium and the Oviedo Shroud, and sometimes called the head shroud because it strictly wrapped the head of this person who we believe is Jesus. So it can be a little bit confusing, but if you want to go ahead and look it up online, read Dr. Bennett's book. What's it called, Philip?
You've got me there. It's got something Sacred Blood, Sacred Image, I think it's called.
We'll put it up on the Spirit Revolution website to give you some more information on how to dig into the Oviedo Shroud material because it's very, very interesting, and I absolutely agree with you, Philip, that it really backs up authenticity of the Shroud of Turin in a huge way that, while it has been explored, I don't think has been explored necessarily as deeply as it should be. Also, the two documentaries that we discussed, the new one, The Real Face of Jesus, and the one that came out in 2006, which is readily available on for lease or for rent or to purchase, called The Fabric of Time. Both of those do show the overlay. What they do is they take the blood spatter images from the Oviedo Shroud and they overlay it on the Shroud of Turin to show you that these are really unusual wounds, very, very unique, one-of-a-kind wounds, and yet both of these pieces of fabric have the identical wounds. When you line them up, they're absolutely perfect, and they actually sort of fit the contours of the face and everything else. There is no room for any kind of doubt when you see it like this that these two pieces of cloth covered the same man. And the other thing I want to say about the pollen, those who don't know anything about this pollen argument, is that this pollen is a pollen that comes very specifically from the Middle East that is on these cloths that have been held in Europe for a very long time.
And just one additional aspect on the Janice Bennett work, which is that she identifies, and I haven't done any further research into this because it's all quite new, so I'm taking Janice Bennett's word on this. She has been studying kind of like where did the Turin Shroud go early on, where did the Oviedo Shroud go to shortly after Easter, shortly after it was found in the tomb. And she has come across some old manuscripts and documents which suggest that the shroud was given to Joseph of Arimathea, the Sudarium of Oviedo was taken by Peter. And she has come across references that early on when Peter began to do his thing, he actually had wrapped the sudarium on top of his head, and whenever he was saying mass or baptizing or performing the sacraments, he did this with the sudarium on top of his head. Now, she then goes into a very interesting detail, which is that people always, and you have highlighted this in your books and in your own research, because you've experienced this when you stand in front of these relics, you get the full power and why they are hidden by the church. Well, she relates the story how in 1988 she was given a very good photograph of the sudarium by an American couple, I believe, and that American couple had been able to touch the photograph to the blood which was on the sudarium. Because the sudarium is taken out three times a year inside the Cathedral of Oviedo, and when you are attending Mass at those three moments in time, you will be able to see the sudarium. So this couple had been able to do that, and they had touched a photograph to the sudarium. And they had given this photograph to Janice Bennett. She begins to relate how on a number of occasions she has used this photograph in healing rituals, both on herself and on other people. And in the limited amount of healing rituals she has performed using this, the effects of healing were always, so to speak, miraculous, if not very fortuitous. Now, Janice is saying this is kind of like, you know, She doesn't try to do this too much. She doesn't go on a roadshow. But it's clear from her writing how powerful and how, like, you know, this woman had to write this down because this is so convincing. And even though she cannot rationalize it in a scientific way yet, there is no doubt in her mind that this is what is happening.
I am working on something, as you know, that we haven't talked about too much publicly, but this idea of where the shroud was and who had it and where it came from originally, and was it originally in the hands of Joseph of Arimathea, and it very well may have been. But one of the things that we see over and over again is that the shroud ends up in the hands of women. There are female caretakers of the shroud, particularly in the late Middle Ages and early Renaissance. There are women involved with the preservation of the shroud, with the veneration of the shroud, with the displaying of the shroud. Very, very powerful women. I believe that we are leaning toward a theory, which I'm still working on, as are you, and we are working on it together. But I want to just sort of put it out there to the world that I believe that this, that the Shroud of Turin in its earliest stages, one of the reasons it does disappear is because it was venerated very privately by what is essentially a heretical sect that is led by women. And I believe that there were women who were the protectors and keepers of the shroud. I believe that they were Magdalens. They were part of this Magdalene line of which I write. And I think that the reason that we don't see the shroud for quite a long time is it is underground like so many other things. And we're going to get into this a little bit when we talk about things like the Libro Rosso, the mysterious red book of heresies of which I write. You know, it's so interesting and so frustrating because how do you prove to history something existed that has intentionally been erased from history? And that's what we're up against with so much of this information.
Before we start doing that, let me just add something which I think I haven't told you, which is that Janice Bennett goes into trying to find out the history of the Oviedo Sudarium, and she identifies the fact that the first reference is in 570 AD. And at that moment in time, you have a traveler who is in Jerusalem or near Jerusalem, and he lists the fact that near a cave near the monastery of St. Mark, seven nuns were protecting the Sudarium. Now, the only reason it seems that they let go of the Sudarium, why it was taken out of Jerusalem, is because from Persia there was an invasion on its way, and they wanted to protect as many Christian relics and Jewish relics and anything which needed to be saved from the Persian invasion. And that is why it went to Alexandria, and then when the Persian invasion reached Alexandria, why it was taken further into northern Africa. But definitely, once again, in the Sudarium, in the 6th century AD, we see seven women in a cave protecting the Sudarium.
Takes a woman.
Now, to go from briefly from a woman to a man, Easter has just been passed, and as usual, that is the time when the Pope, in this case Pope Benedict, stands on top of St. Peter and proclaims to the world in various languages that it is Easter time, and he also quite often gives a listing of what is kind of like the agenda of the church and what should be done. I think we're both in agreement that this weekend was really where the church should have hired a different public relations person, because it didn't really go down well, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, I think that the actions of the Catholic Church this weekend were offensive to me as a believer. I think they were offensive to a lot of people. To me as a human, they were offensive. I think at best they were bizarre, and I think at worst they were reprehensible. And for those who are not familiar with what happened this weekend, of course this is the holiest weekend of the year for Christians worldwide, 2 billion of us. And this is really our time to meditate, to celebrate, to really look at what this extraordinary gift is that we have that comes from the grace that we get from Jesus. Now, of course, this is me speaking as a believer, but even if you're not a believer, once again, this is an incredibly powerful and personal day for one third of the planet. So the Pope and the church, who are supposed to stand for something in terms of preserving and protecting and venerating this incredibly holy day and period, actually, because it's from Good Friday to Easter, used it as a public relations opportunity to defend themselves over the pedophilia scandals and all of the scandals that the church has been up against because they have protected pedophiles for such a very long time. And that's not my opinion. That's a fact. We know that the church has protected pedophiles within the church. That does not make me anti-Catholic. That does not make me, you know, opinionated. It's just a fact. We know that factually. There's all kinds of evidence that this has happened. And so what occurred this week is first of all, what happened on Good Friday is, to me, completely incomprehensible. So what we have on Good Friday is we have the papal preacher, Father Cantalamessa, delivering a Good Friday homily to the Pope and to senior Vatican officials. And in this homily, he compares the media coverage of the recent scandals to the centuries of persecution against the Jews. I mean, am I the only one who thinks this is outrageous that they did this? First of all, the complete and utter disrespect for the solemnity and the importance of Good Friday by, instead of honoring the sacrifice of Jesus, to stand up there and say, oh, look at us, we are the persecuted, and then comparing themselves to the horrific persecution of the Jews, I just think is completely outrageous. Am I overreacting, or is it just baffling?
and specifically because the church sometimes had something to do with the persecution of the Jews as well. So it's not like as if they're comparing themselves to something which is very far from their heart. But no, I don't think you're overreacting. And what I heard other people say from within the Vatican corner or those who are paid by them is that somehow there's this conspiracy theory now, that they are the victim of this conspiracy theory. And it always upsets me when people who have so much worldly power use this against themselves as a defense, because the fact is that, you know, to conspire against the Vatican takes an awful lot of clout. You just don't start doing that with five men in the street. So if it was true that there is this conspiracy against the Vatican, well, then, you know, then it's definitely from very powerful people. But, you know, let the Vatican shoot themselves in the foot here, because as you pointed out, even if it's orchestrated, it is not without causal foundation. There is no denying the fact that people have been sexually abused by priests. And I was reading, I can't remember where, I think it was on the Huffington Post, the blog, where a guy who had been abused as a child by a Catholic priest was invited to come to Rome, speak and meet with the Pope, and the Pope, this one, said, "I will look into this, I will do actions." And pretty much the guy said, and the next thing we found out was that the Pope pretty much did nothing at all. And in fact, that the Pope is now been found out to consistently tell people not to investigate. And that is the serious crime. It's not the fact that there are some rotten apples within the Catholic Church. Every organization has a bad apple. And quite often it's up to the CEO and to his great happiness that he is able to weed those out. What we have here is a leader of a church who just says, "Oh, I'm so sorry what happened to you," and then actually says, "We don't care about you. We only care about our church. We have no interest whatsoever in trying to go against one of ours. Simply," and I use this not in the simple term, "simply because you were sexually abused as a child." That is just so wrong.
Well, you know, again, as you say, this is not about the fact that there has been this aberrational, awful behavior within the church. That in itself is a terrible thing. But you can't condemn the entire church structure for that. You can, however, condemn the entire church structure for covering that up to the point of obstruction of justice. And that is the part that needs to be addressed. And that's really the crux of the issue here, is that people in power allowed this to happen. And they did allow it to happen, because it happened over and over and over again. And back to this idea that the Pope has invited people to come and talk to him. Well, let me tell you something. That is a new idea, because there are a lot of victims who asked to be heard in Rome and were refused repeatedly. In the 2006 documentary, Deliver Us from Evil, documentary filmmaker Amy Berg does a fantastic job of showing you the path of some of these victims. This specifically deals with issues that happened in California, but it follows the victims of this one particular predatory priest who was moved all over the state, even though Cardinal Mahoney knew exactly what he was doing. And then we also find out later that Cardinal Ratzinger, who is now Pope Benedict XVI, also had a lot of information about what was happening. And this is back, you know, in the early, this is 10 years ago. Documentaries made in 2006, but these events happened in the 90s. So what we have as we follow these victims is we show them going to Rome, and these are devoted Catholics. And they are heartbroken, and they are distraught over what has happened to them. And they go to Rome, and they say, "Please hear us. Please meet with us. Please talk to us." And the doors are slammed in their face every single time. No one from the church would meet with them. So I don't, you know, I think that is one of the things that's really, really important, is just how many times the very highest ranking officials in the Vatican have refused to listen to the victims here. And so for the church then to grandstand about this and start screaming that they are the victims during the holiest week of the year is, again, to me, incomprehensible. And really more than disappointing. I find it just incredibly sad and really offensive to the victims who've been through so much already. And I just want to say, too, as someone who spends most of my life defending women who have tried to make a difference in spirituality and women who have been maligned by the church for 2,000 years, I find it incredibly ironic that the Catholic Church, particularly this Pope, is screaming that they are the victims of a smear campaign. Now, that's irony.
That definitely is. Now, that kind of like paints, I think, from Easter all the way to 2010, the career of the Vatican Church, of Catholicism, of Christianity, and how it goes from this miracle which happens and which is witnessed by a very few select people all the way to this world-dominating institution which has worldly power and which has 2 billion adherents. An awful lot of things have happened along the way, and obviously you, Kathleen, in your Magdalene series, you highlight the other side of Christianity, so to speak, the side which never gets a hearing, the side which literally gets written out of the books, and which you are writing back into books. We are going to go into the Libro Rosso in far more detail at some other moment in time, because it's impossible to do even in just one broadcast, let alone half a broadcast. But there are various things which went from the most miraculous event that ever happened, or potentially have ever happened, to the situation we're in right now, which is disastrous, and whereby it is really a dire strait. So the Libro Rosso, which is what you have been focusing on, is actually that core of Christianity, what it should have been, but the core which has been lost.
Well, you know, it's funny because yesterday on Easter Sunday, my Facebook status post was a reinterpretation of a particular biblical quote. And what I said is this: he said, "Woman, why weepest thou?" And she said, "Because 2,000 years later, they still have no idea what we were trying to tell them." And that was something that really struck me so hard yesterday. I always go out at dawn on Easter and, you know, pick flowers or do something to be out, you know, in the dawn and really celebrate Easter personally, myself, because I have also found that, you know, given that I believe what I believe about Jesus and Mary Magdalene, that it's very difficult for me to go to a traditional church. I still do. I attend a church somewhere every Good Friday for 3 hours. I'm always hoping that I will find a service or a community that I really feel like I belong with. I never do. That when, as I listen to the story of Passion Week, I always have to do a lot of reframing in my head. So I've learned over the years to do some of my own celebrations. And one of mine is this Easter morning thing that I do when I go out at dawn. And that was what came to me. I was imagining Mary Magdalene 2,000 years ago, you know, coming to the sepulcher on Easter morning and having Jesus say to her, "Woman, why weepest thou?" And what they would say if they were here today. And I think that they would both say, "You guys keep missing the point. I mean, do you really think that Jesus on Easter Sunday would want to watch a cardinal stand up prior to the Pope's address and say, 'Look, we're really not guilty of all this and we're victims of a smear campaign,' because it happened again on Easter? It wasn't enough for them to make this statement on Good Friday. They then did it on Easter." And I just can't imagine that anything that's happened in the last 2,000 years in terms of traditional institutionalized church would really make either Jesus or Mary Magdalene very happy. You know, and I, you know, I'll probably get a lot of criticism for saying that, but, you know, I just, what would Jesus do? I'll tell you what Jesus would not do. Jesus would not stand up and defend these actions of the church the way that this happened over the weekend. And so, as you say, it's part of a bigger picture. It's not just this particular incident. It's this whole idea that so much of Christianity, and specifically Catholicism, has become about world power. It's become about power and economics, and not the least about spirituality. I don't hear these cardinals and these papal preachers from the Vatican defending the spirituality of Christians. I hear them defending a world power. I hear them defending a business and institution. And I don't believe that that's what Jesus was trying to tell us 2,000 years ago.
And definitely in his actions, he went into the temple and tossed about and turned about a few tables because pretty much he didn't like what was happening in the Jewish temple.
Well, I think that he'd be turning over a few tables in St. Peter's if he were here today. I really do. Of course, we have no way of knowing that. But, you know, I take my What Would Jesus Do bracelet very seriously, and I think we really need to think about it. You know, you asked me a question about the Libro Rosso, and for those who are listening who have never heard of it, Libro Rosso, of course, means the red book. And it is a reference to heretical material that has existed since the time of Christ that has been handed down through this sort of shadow aspect of Christianity that did not conform with what was happening dogmatically, politically, economically in Rome. It became heretical information, and the people who protected it became heretics. And as a result, millions of them died during the Inquisition and elsewhere. Many of them were victims of crusades. They were massacred. They were butchered. What these people endured is beyond our comprehension for believing a series of teachings that are essentially similar to what we see in the Gnostic material, but an expanded version thereof. This book called the Libro Rosso originated in Italy. It was a copy of what we call the Book of Love. My last book is about this. The Book of Love tells the story of this book, what it is, what it became, where it went. Certainly, again, we know the original disappeared. The original, by the way, is believed to have been written in Jesus' own hand. So there is this incredible idea that there once existed a document that Jesus created himself to say, this is what I'm trying to say. And that document becomes the most dangerous thing in the world to what is now evolved into the Roman Catholic Church, because certainly much of what is in this document opposes this very idea of empire. Because that's what we're talking about with the Vatican, really. We're talking about empire. And I think that Jesus was an anti-imperialist in his heart and his soul. So what happens is we have this heretical material that's floating around Europe. And then, again, because it is so dangerous, by its very nature, it has to be protected. It has to be secret. The people who revere it want to keep it a secret. The people that despise it want to keep it a secret. So once again, how do you prove the existence of something that history has made a concerted effort to eliminate? And the answer is you have to really go beyond the existing documentation and start looking at other things. You have to start looking at art. How many thousands of times this red book shows up in some of these heretical locations, painted on frescoes in monasteries from Greece to the south of France to Tuscany. There's all of this sort of architectural and artistic information that tells us that people revered a red book that was completely separate from what the church was having them read traditionally. And this is where the legend of the Libro Rosso really gets started. And as you said, it is a topic for its own show in terms of what it really contained. Because in addition to these original teachings of Christ, it is also this incredible documentary evidence of the bloodline families, the families who were descended from Jesus, both genetically and spiritually, and what they were teaching. And a lot of this information comes from the women. The women were the scribes in this order. And we see that over and over again. We see it in Catharism. We see it in a lot of the heretical cultures, that these women were educated and these women were taking the notes essentially on what was happening in their time. So part of the belief is that this was all contained within the Libro Rosso. So the question is, does the Libro Rosso still exist? And if it does, where is it and how do we reclaim that information? Because it is time for us to go back to the very roots of this thing and start over. That's what it's time to do.
And when that kind of like began to happen almost by default, I mean, you once again see the power struggle of the church. I'm thinking here of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi writings. Specifically, the Nag Hammadi writings, I always find, were so telling because they were hidden because the church began to do some of its persecutions. And they were hidden in caves, and just like the Dead Sea Scrolls were hidden in caves. And when this information began to become once again accessible to us in the during the 20th century, 1945, and then in the 1950s, for the Dead Sea Scroll, you can see the power struggle of the church to keep the lid on this, to keep this contained, because literally they knew that every single word they had, which they had been defending for generations, could be overturned by somebody translating these Gospels in a correct way, but without church approval. And church approval was so sought, and actually very few books are written about it. Michael Bagent and Richard Lee write about the Dead Sea Scrolls deception a bit, and it kind of like goes quite a good way actually to kind of like show how all of this subject was treated. But the tremendous power struggle and how the translation was delayed for years and years and years, and how people like Ronald DeVoe were struggling to keep a lid on making sure that everybody did exactly the way it was supposed to, because they were treating documents which had not been in the hands of the church, which had been written by people who had no interest in defending the Vatican. These were people who were preaching about Christianity in wherever they were. Quite often, just people with this book who went out into the desert, and whoever they chanced upon began reading what was either in the Gospel of Mary Magdalene or the Gospel of Philip or whatever Gospel they had upon them. And it is that original Christianity which came out through some discoveries in the 20th century, which once again the church is still struggling with. And it just shows that so little has changed. And that, yes, this ground movement which Jesus initiated kept going for a while until people just usurped the power and made it into something which I personally think Jesus would have hated.
Well, the first century apostles, both male and female, were really the first spirit revolutionaries, or certainly the first spiritual revolutionaries coming from the Christian world. And they were truly revolutionary. I mean, remember, Jesus is essentially executed for his revolutionary ideas. That's what he is originally executed for. And part of this revolution is about saying that the kingdom of God is for everyone, male, female, old, young, rich, poor, clean, unclean, everyone has access to grace. And that is the beauty of this teaching. And the other piece of it, especially when you get into the Gnostic material, you see how much of this is about having a personal relationship with the divine. This is very much what Jesus is teaching us. He tells us in the Gospels to go and talk to God ourselves. He says, don't go to the church. Don't go to the temple. He doesn't say church. He says temple. He says, go behind your own closed door. So it is just you alone and you and God, and talk to God. So here we have revolutionary master teacher who is telling us you need to go have your own personal relationship with God, and you don't need anybody else in between you. And this is what he's teaching. Of course, that is not going to be compatible to the building of an empire. Okay, there is no empire that can be built based on the concepts of love and faith and charity and having a personal relationship with the divine, because it was never meant to be an empire. It was meant to be a powerful, transformational, spiritual way to live on this planet. And that is what we have gotten so far away from. And this is where the spirit revolution comes back in. It is our responsibility as spirit revolutionaries to go back to these original teachings and to start claiming them again. And I want us to talk about something really exciting personally that happened to me this week. I got an email from one of our friends in France telling me that she is going to be conducting a marriage ceremony in the church in Rennes-le-Château next month. For a couple who is going to be using the material from the Book of Love as their marriage service. And that is so exciting to me, because what that says is this: we are bringing back this material from early Christianity, this material that was once so dangerous that you would die for even talking about it. And we are now in a time in the 21st century where we can bring this back. And it is so beautiful, and it is so powerful, and it is so much about love. So for me to know that there is a couple who's going to get married in Rennes Le Château using this material is a sign that the spirit revolution is upon us, and we are moving into a new era that is far more about love and divine connection than it is about empire.
And it's just such a wonderful coincidence that it's also happening in Rennes Le Château and not in any other place on this planet. So I think that is the best news of the day. And I think it's also the perfect means of bidding you once again farewell. This was another episode of The Spirit Revolution. Until next time.
Thank you so much. The truth against the world. It's been great being with you. We'll see you next week, or we'll hear you next week.